Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
Mistletoe and Malice by Laurie D. Young. He's sworn to protect her life, but guarding his heart may be his biggest challenge. After barely escaping an attempted abduction, Houston attorney Riley Hudson is forced to accept her wealthy father's demand for private security. The last thing she wants is a bodyguard, especially one as maddeningly arrogant, bossy, and handsome as Colton Blankenship. Yet as the threat against her escalates, she begins to rely not only on his skills, but his steadfast presence. Colton isn't thrilled about giving up his hard-earned holiday vacation to protect a spoiled heiress, but he soon learns Riley is nothing like he expected. Fierce, independent, and unwavering in her faith, she's everything he thought he'd left behind after tragedy shattered his own beliefs. As the unknown threat circles closer, the tension between them ignites into something deeper and far more perilous. When a second attempt on Riley's life nearly succeeds, Colton faces a terrifying truth. Protecting her means risking more than just his life. Haunted by a past he can't outrun and a faith he's all but lost, he must decide if he can trust God again, before he loses Riley and his heart for good.
On this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense, I'm chatting with Laurie D. Young, a contemporary Christian romance author who enjoys penning stories full of grace and the redemptive power of God's love that inspire others to hope regardless of the circumstance. So welcome to my show, Laurie.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So for you, it sounds like you've written some romance and now you're dipping into romantic suspense. What's the hardest part for you of writing romantic suspense?
That would have to be the actual suspense thread, because my previous series was just contemporary romance, didn't have a suspense element or a mystery to it. So it was a bit of a departure for me. And this book, too, tends to skew more toward the romance, but there is a definite suspense thread that I had to wind through the story. So hopefully letting it unfold as it should. That was the hardest part for me, was timing as to when certain things should happen, not too fast, but not too slowly that the reader loses interest, that type of thing.
Yeah, that's always difficult for me. I focus more on writing the suspense, and then I'm like, oh yeah, they have to fall in love, so I have to go back in and layer their romance in.
I'm just opposite of that.
Yeah, and it's not that it's that super hard for me to write the romance part. It's just that I focus so much on the suspense because I love not giving away who is the culprit, who is after them. Mm-hmm. So I try to leave some of those breadcrumbs, those red herrings, having to be multiple people or no one, and have them figure how they figure that out. But then I have to go back in and add a little bit more of that romance in there. Can't forget the romance.
I hear you on that.
I know. I mean, it's fun. You know, it's our minds all work different ways. I don't know anyone who does like all the threads equally well, easily. Mm-hmm. I guess equally easily, I will say.
A good word for it. Easily. It's not easy.
No, it's not. I think we all have different parts where we struggle a little more with. So what about the inspiration for your plots? Where do you find that inspiration?
I wish I had a very, smart answer for this. I don't have a super great answer. I get ideas for plots just from anywhere, everywhere. Something I see, something I read about, or even something I might remember from my own life will give me ideas for plots. Like, what would happen if this person who believed this got involved with this person who believed that? And then what if this person was trying to thwart them? You know, so I mean, it's just, I try to think anything can inspire me. People watching at the airport, whatever it is. I'm not a plotter. So I usually only have a loose plot line in my head, and that evolves as I develop my characters, so I can really get inspiration from anywhere, because it doesn't have to be like a fully fleshed out thought. It can just be a little nugget, and then I just kind of go from there and flesh out characters that might work in that plot, and then it kind of evolves from there.
Yeah, I hear you. I am definitely not a plotter. I've been becoming a little bit better at writing like shorter, you know, my synopsis are pretty short. You know, somebody said, oh, I wrote like a 10-page single space synopsis. I'm like, I might as well have written a whole book if I did that.
Right. Exactly.
You know, I cannot get that detailed. So, yeah, because I'll just start with a general idea as well and just kind of flesh it out. And the characters tell me what they want to do. So, you know, what can I
Absolutely.
Say?
Absolutely. Right.
Which
They're in charge.
They're in charge. They are in charge. So how do you find that building that connection with your fictional characters? How do you connect with them?
I do a lot of character development. I'm very character driven. It's my favorite part. I love making people and I love living with them, and I'll live with them for, you know, a few weeks before I actually start any of the like writing part of it. I know their Enneagram. I know their birth order, love language. I know what they drive, what they live in, how they dress. I love going online and like buying them things, not for real, but I've gone online and made cars for them. And of course, then I get all the ads. Every time I'm online, I get all the ads for whatever car I just built. I like to find houses for them, see how they dress. I know what she might carry in her handbag or backpack, and I know what he keeps in his glove compartment. As I go through my life, I just think, what would they do here at the grocery store? Or what would they do? How would they pay attention? Would they pay attention in church? Would they even go to church? Would they raise their hands in worship? You know, all of this. And I know about their background. So I really, really, really just live with them. I think it sounds weird to anyone who's not an author. I think all of us are used to those voices in our heads just kind of saying, hey, this is me. And so I just really pray over that too, that whoever I bring into the story will just enhance it to, you know, for that storyline of faith. So it's just really important for me to know my characters inside and out. I kind of think of them as my best friends for a little while.
Well, they kind of are our best friends. I mean, I don't do quite that in depth of a thing because I don't know. I write a little more organically where I just start writing. I'm like, oh, well, this is the car they would drive. Of course it's the car they would drive.
Oh.
But if you would ask me, you know, before I write it, I just don't have an answer. it's just the way. I mean, I'll find out if they're an only child, if their parents are, you know, I'll do a little bit of that. But if I do too much, I start getting bored with it. And I just am like, I'm just done. I got nothing for you. But at the end of the story, obviously they're pretty well developed characters,
exactly.
kind of thing. So it's just I've always find it fascinating how our minds we just all work differently and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
But let's talk a little bit more about the writing thing in general. Do you find anything very frustrating writing romantic suspense?
The only thing I found frustrating or difficult was just having two arcs in the story, the romance arc, which I'm used to, and then there was the suspense arc, which is new for me. So I tried, when I first started this book, I tried writing a third POV in the villain's head, from the villain's point of view, but my critique partners, and I even had a gentleman from my local writers group here read over my book, because he writes cozy mysteries and he has a lot of background in some of the things that were addressed in my book. And everybody to a person said, that takes me completely out of the story because it's not you. It's very dark. It's very, you know, it's jarring. And I thought, you know, I think what I'm trying to do is go too much into suspense where I'm really more comfortable with romance. So I took the villain POV out and just kind of started writing from there, and it just fell into place. I thought, this is great because the reader is discovering things at the same time that the characters are. They're not getting a preview of what's in this person's head. And so they don't know, again, who it is or what's going on until the characters do. And that worked so much better for me. So there's still only the two POVs in my book, So that was probably the most frustrating thing for me, was just the stops and starts, trying to figure out what's going to work for me and as the writer and for my story and the story I wanted to tell, and what doesn't, you know, what does work and what doesn't work. Took a little while.
Yeah. Sometimes it does, and you may find as you develop as a writer, a romantic suspense writer, that you may want to revisit that later. But it doesn't necessarily have to have multiple points of view in the romantic suspense genre. But what have you found to be the most rewarding about writing romantic suspense?
I think pretty much the same as I have felt with all of my books. I love having a satisfying ending where good wins and evil loses. That even happens in just contemporary romance because a lot, you know, in my books anyway, they're dealing with real life issues, and overcoming those issues is where evil loses, the devil loses. But I think that's just elevated in romantic suspense because you have this element of discovering whodunit. Like that feeling when you put that last piece of the puzzle in and you're like, oh, I did the puzzle. You feel so accomplished. I think that was what was so satisfying and rewarding for me, was when it all came together at the end and I could see all those threads, you know, tying up, and I was like, oh, I did it. You know, so that was very, just coming to the end and thinking, okay, I think this worked. And of course, you know, my editors loved it and my critique partners loved it. So I kind of felt like, okay, maybe this is all going to work out great for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's wonderful, especially when you're trying something new, a little bit new genre for you. It's always great when we get to the end and realize, oh yeah, this was good. I'm glad I made, for me, sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm glad I made that person the villain. Yeah, that works. That will work better.
Yes,
I don't always know who's
definitely.
going to be the bad guy until the end. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It
Oh,
depends on the story. Yeah, I'll have several
wow.
options and I'm like, oh yeah, that would be better. And sometimes I usually discover it pretty quick. Within the first like fourth of the book, I kind of decide. But sometimes I'm in build,
Wow.
sometimes I don't have a clear reason for that or why that would happen. Well, we are
That's so
almost out of time.
interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's just the way my brain works. We're almost out of time, Lori, but I would love for you to share what is absolutely essential for you to write as we wrap up.
Well, I think I'm one of those rare writers who actually has to have some noise in order to stay focused. So, I mean, my mind is a natural born wanderer, and if it's too quiet, I find it wandering to other things. And music has always played a very important role in my life, and it helps me stay focused. And I usually have music going, anything from Christian contemporary music, praise and worship music, or just instrumental music, like Lindsey Stirling and, you know, some of that kind of stuff. But it's usually dictated by the scene I'm writing at any given time. So if it's a romance, I don't really want to be having something that's really, really deep. And, you know, if it's something that is really, really deep, I don't want to have a love song going on in the background. But, and then I absolutely have to have ice water. I have to have ice water. So it's surprising how much of a thirst writing can work up, but that's a given. I have a big, huge water bottle, and I keep that with me all the time.
I love that. Stay hydrated. That's always good advice. Whether you're writing
Absolutely.
or what, writing uses a lot of brain cells. We have to keep lubricated. So,
Absolutely.
yeah. That's great. Well, it has been such a pleasure talking with you today, Lori. So thank you so much for being on my show.
Well, thank you for having me. It really was fun. I enjoyed it.
Now an excerpt from Mistletoe and Malice by Lori DeYoung. I met someone, Rye. Riley grinned at her friend seated across from her at the cozy cafe, the promise of new love sparkling in Caitlin's blue eyes. Explains the dreamy grin you've been wearing since I got here. Leaning over her garden salad, Caitlin's smile widened. Her eyes shone brighter than the Christmas lights on the tree standing sentinel in the restaurant's front window. He's incredible. I've never felt so much so fast for anybody. Ladling a spoonful of lobster bisque, Riley regarded her across the table. I'm so happy for you, Kate. Has your dad met this guy? Caitlin's smile dimmed as she sat back in her chair and picked up her fork. You know my father. Nobody will ever be good enough. And Shane doesn't come with a name, at least not one that will pass muster with Dad. Riley cocked her head. How'd you meet then?
At the club. He was working in the golf shop last month when I went in for a new glove. We talked for a bit. I saw him a few times working around the club, and he finally asked if I'd like to go for coffee.
We met the next morning and talked for hours. Good thing it was Saturday, so he wasn't late for work.
An employee? You're not concerned he's trying to get close to you for the wrong reasons?
Like that guy last year who kept asking you out?
Kate rolled her eyes. You mean that Jacob guy? He was harmless. I never saw or heard from him after that day you saw him bugging me and told me to report him.
And did you report him?
No. I decided if he didn't get the message, I would. Guess he moved on to someone else. But Shane's not an employee. He's an IT contractor hired to overhaul the club's computer system. The day we met, he was installing software on the golf shop computer. He did such good work that they gave him a lifetime membership gratis. We've seen each other every day since that first coffee. We work out, play tennis, golf. He loves all that stuff as much as I do.
He sounds amazing. Riley took a sip of the warm bisque, perfect on this rainy mid-December day. What does he think about your work as a social media influencer?
Caitlin shrugged. He wasn't sure what to make of it at first, me living my life in front of the world. But then he saw it's only a part of my life I let them see. What products I'm endorsing, where I'm traveling, events I attend, and now my faith.
After taking a dainty bite of her salad, Caitlin regarded her again. When you led me to the Lord 6 months ago, that didn't sit well with my dad when I shared my decision with my family. Not at all. Now? She shook her head. I bring home this middle-class boyfriend and I'm sure to get another earful about my poor choices. Sighing, she pushed a cherry tomato around leaves of radicchio and kale, her gaze following its path. I'm dreading it, but I know I need to introduce them soon. She put her fork down and brought her shining eyes back to Riley. Because I think this guy could be the one. We just click.
Riley's heart went out to her friend. The path before her could be a difficult one if she should choose Shane over her father's wishes. But Caitlin was one of the bravest women she'd ever met. It wouldn't be the first time she got on the wrong side of her status-focused parents. Thankfully, Riley's own family put more stock in integrity and breadth of character than net worth.
Makes a good living, but Dad won't be happy with anything less than 7 figures a year. I'm praying he'll take all the other things into account, though.
Riley set her spoon on the saucer under her bowl.
Okay, here's the big question. Is he a man of faith? I know you're new to your own, but I hope that's a non-starter if he's not.
Oh, he is, definitely. Her smile broadened. I've been attending his church with him, and he prays with me, Rye. Isn't that amazing?
It was, and Riley couldn't be happier for her friend.
Just make sure I'm invited to the wedding, if he is indeed the one.
Caitlin giggled. Oh, honey, you'll be standing right up there with me.
With his 9mm Glock resting in its shoulder holster under his suit coat, Colton watched the post-funeral guest milling quietly around the opulent living room of the Honorable Josiah Mullaney. Their older daughter had married and now lived in her own estate in the Woodlands. Their younger daughter had been lowered into the ground that afternoon, under a late April sun, in a box befitting a woman of her means. Rosewood, the officiant had said at the funeral. A rare and beautiful wood for the rare and beautiful Caitlin Rose Mullaney. Colton moved to the entry hall. He felt like an interloper, a voyeur watching grief penetrate this place like a fog, dense and dark without remedy. This fog would never go away. He knew that all too well. Nodding to his co-worker stationed at the front door, he turned to scan the room.
You ate?
Yes, sir. You?
Not yet.
Go get a bite. This place is locked down tighter than the White House. I can keep an eye on the senator from here and let you know if he wants to leave.
Not hungry.
Then at least go get some air. It's been a trying day.
Colton shot a glance at Trevor, a fairly new agent with the private security firm he'd been with for the past 4 years. He'd have to do a better job at not letting his personal life seep into his work. Still, Trevor had a point. Some fresh air might help him regroup.
I'll be back in 10.
The job usually kept his mind and body busy, which he preferred to days like today, when he had too much time on his hands to think, to feel, more than he'd wanted to over the past year, 7 months, and 4 days. At the graveside, he'd been on alert, watching for anyone who might be a threat to the senator after a high-profile vote last month had garnered more hate mail than normal. Here at the estate, though, there was nothing for them to do but cool their heels, at least until the senator was ready to return to his own River Oaks estate, which he kept as well as the brownstone he used in the nation's capital. He let himself out a back door into the waning sunlit afternoon. Dusk would settle in soon, and darkness after that, as it did every day, day in, day out, repeat. Life went on, never waiting for grief to loosen its insidious grip. His gaze raked the area around the large terrace, his focus landing on a woman seated on a stone bench, head bowed and arms crossed over her stomach. The door shut with a soft click behind him, and her head snapped around. "I'm sorry." He'd assumed she'd been crying, but there were no tears that he could see. "I didn't mean to disturb you. I'll go back inside." "No, it's okay." She stood and smoothed her dress over narrow hips. "Just having a little talk with God." She took a few steps in his direction. "I don't want to keep all this sunshine to myself." Praying. She'd been praying. Something he hadn't done in, well, 1 year, 7 months, and 4 days. As she moved closer, his brain took the usual notes. Shoulder-length dark hair worn straight and pulled behind her ears. Bangs that brushed her eyebrows. Petite and slender. No doubt another society princess, if the obviously expensive black dress she wore was any clue. Not to mention the ridiculously high-heeled red-soled shoes, designer sunglasses, the diamond pendant around her neck, matching earrings, and tennis bracelet on her delicate wrist. She halted a few feet away and crossed her arms over her middle. "Are you a friend of the Mulaneys?" "No, ma'am. I'm on the job." "What job would that be?" "Peterson Security. Personal protection detail." One eyebrow hitched, and she pushed her sunglasses up onto her head, revealing eyes that competed with the emerald ring for most intense color. "And who are you protecting, personally, from out here?" He held back a chuckle. This one had spunk. He could hear it in her voice, see it in the set of her shoulders. Pulled back, confident. "Senator Congdon. But I'm not needed until we leave the premises." "I see." When he said nothing further, she offered her hand. "Riley Hudson." "Of course. Daughter of Andrew Hudson, one of the Houston moguls sitting with the grieving judge and the senator inside. A billionaire financier and another of Peterson Security International's high-profile clients. The Hudsons didn't have a protection detail per se, although Peterson installed and manned the high-tech security system at their posh estate. Their driver was also a Peterson security specialist, a.k.a. bodyguard, as needed. He gave her hand a quick squeeze and let go. "Miss Hudson." Anxious to take his leave, he didn't offer his name. He wasn't there to make friends, and his 10 minutes were about to expire. "I take it the guy with the earpiece by the door is with you?" "Yes, ma'am." She turned her eyes to the horizon with the sun settling into its journey to the other side of the globe, eyes shimmering with the fallout of grief. Yet she held a measure of quiet strength about her, not like she would fall apart any second. Fortunate, because comforting a distraught woman was not among his specific skill set. He cleared his throat. "I'm sorry about your friend. Everything I heard today tells me she was special. Beyond. She wasn't..." She waved her arm around. "All of this. She had depth, intelligence. People didn't give her enough credit, what with her online presence and all. But everything she did was done with purpose, with thought." She swallowed and crossed her arms again as her gaze went back to the grounds beyond the terrace. Only 4 months ago, she was practically giddy about Shane. "I can't believe it. It doesn't make sense." She shook her head and turned back to him. "She shouldn't have died like this. Nobody should die like this." His chest tightened at the anguish in her eyes. He'd been on the other side of the country when Miss Mulaney had reportedly been found dead by her boyfriend, stabbed over 20 times in her own kitchen. That same boyfriend now sat in jail, Caitlin Mulaney's blood on his hands. And if there were any justice in the world, Shane Everett would be locked away in a cage for the rest of his life.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.